Hello and welcome to Politico's 2016 Nerdcast, where we bring you the stories behind the stories and geek out on this amazing circus of an election. It's Thursday, July 21st, and I'm Kristen Roberts, Politico's national editor. This week, we're coming to you from the Republican National Convention in Cleveland, and what an amazing event this has been. Here are the numbers that mattered this week at the RNC. 23. The length of the speech Ted Cruz gave that got him booed off stage and into the history books. 4. The number of speakers who did more for Donald Trump than the rest of the convention combined. And 30. That's how many mega donors showed up here in Cleveland for a private meeting with the super PAC that has won Donald Trump's blessing. So grab your calculators and enjoy the 2016 Nerdcast. Hello to my Cleveland crew, Eli Stokols.
Hey, Kristen.
Ken Vogel.
Hey.
And senior politics editor Charlie Matassian.
Hi, Kristen.
We're getting a lot of good questions from our listeners. And before we launch into our Cleveland conversation, let's first hear from Paul. Hello out there, Paul. What's your question?
Hi there. So as a college student and soon-to-be voter in my first presidential election, I'm always perplexed, and have been particularly as of late, by what seems to be an odd paradox, which is that all candidates clamor for this youth vote. And when they do get it, they tout it around as a symbol of great importance that's somehow indicative of their appeal and viability writ large. But in academic circles, and also in a lot of intellectual political coverage, people seem to sort of deride the notion that the youth vote matters much, if at all. So all that said, I'm wondering whether or not you guys believe that this electoral cycle will present a turning point in the status quo of the youth voting.
That's a great question. Charlie?
Well, I think, Paul, you're right about the media's tendency to dismiss the youth vote. I have to say, up until about 2008, I was so tired of the youth vote story, which is every 4 years you'd see these terrible, boring stories about, oh, America's youth is going to come out and there's going to be a tidal wave of support for the candidate, and then they never show up. But 2008 changed everything with Barack Obama. This year, it's a little more uncertain because what we've seen, at least historically, is you saw two huge youth turnout waves, one of which in 1972 and another in 2008. And I think in those situations, you had candidates who truly connected with youthful voters. McGovern in 72, Barack Obama in 2008. I don't know that you really see candidates of the same ilk this time. And in fact, you've got two deeply polarizing candidates who are also very, you know, let's be honest, they're pretty old. Donald Trump's 70 years old. Hillary's not much younger. And so I'm not expecting a huge wave this year of young voters willing to be proven wrong, but I just don't see it.
Paul, thanks so much for writing. I hope you do keep writing and send us some comments and criticisms and even more questions.
Absolutely. Thanks so much.
Awesome. See you. Bye.
Thanks, Paul.
All right, let's get to the data. First data point, 23. Now, Ted Cruz's prepared remarks on Wednesday night were supposed to last 9 minutes. Instead, they lasted 23, and what an incredible moment. Of all the conventions any of us has ever covered, this might be the thing that we all remember more than anything. No, Eli?
Pretty dramatic, right? And I mean, but sort of par for the course for this convention. I mean, most of the time, the people sitting in the little hallway of the convention have, there's a couple offices with lawyers and speechwriters, and they're like redlining and vetting and approving all of the speeches. And you assume that's happening here. I've been told they have those people. But you watch the speeches, and sometimes it hasn't seemed like it. I mean, these speeches and this program has just kind of been all over the map from the very first night when the two Navy SEALs were just sitting up there riffing, like doing sort of a Laurel and Hardy but very sinister comedy routine and retelling of being in Benghazi. I mean, it was just
Well, the first night was a disaster.
It was very strange. All of it has been very strange and a little less buttoned up and scripted and polished than what you're used to seeing at these conventions. And so, you know, the Ted Cruz situation is of a whole nother. I mean, the fact that they even let him speak, which afterwards everybody's like, you knew he wasn't going to endorse you. You saw the speech and you still let him do it. I think Ted Cruz sort of ad-libbed and went beyond what he turned in as his sort of, you know, here's my speech. But, I mean, it's just sort of, right, like this was the guy setting up Eric Trump, who was setting up Mike Pence, and it just sort of, again, in terms of planning, like today they're saying how magnanimous they were. You know, we were the bigger man, which is a hilarious sentence to say out loud, but that's what Donald Trump Jr. said about the Trump family and campaign, saying we're going to let him speak anyway, even though we knew he was going to stiff us. And yet, like, it still makes no sense.
I don't agree with you at all about this. I mean, Charlie, I'm looking at your face and I think you're on my team here. I think this was a really smart move by Donald Trump to put him on the stage knowing what Ted Cruz was going to do.
I think it might have diminished Trump to have squelched Ted Cruz's voice. And here's the other thing that I can't help but think. It made for great reality TV, and let's face it, Donald Trump is a master of that. What if he understood that there would be some drama, but he was okay with that because the narrative would be great and people would be talking about it and nobody would be talking about the plagiarism or the disastrous first night? So I wouldn't put it past Trump to have sort of envisioned a scenario, not the way it played out, but one that was a little bit ugly and drew lots of eyeballs.
You know what I think, though? I think it played out better than he probably expected it to. What were the chyrons afterward? Everyone was, Ted Cruz gets booed off stage. It didn't just take Melania and the plagiarism out of the headlines. Think of the alternative. If he had yanked Ted Cruz off the stage at the last minute, everybody today would have been talking about Donald Trump squashing dissent.
Yeah, you should have to put this in context. I mean, look at how the rest of the convention has gone. There's absolutely no evidence to lead anyone to believe that this is a well-orchestrated master plan, that they even have the ability to do the basics, let alone a very complicated, choreographed, sort of WWE type of, chair on the slap, hitting the back of the referee type of moment. I just don't, I wouldn't put it past them to have the motivation to try to do that, and certainly the Cruz people have played into that narrative by saying that they were set up, but I just don't think that they have that kind of capacity and aptitude despite all the convention veterans that they brought in to try to run this thing.
Can I just say, though, for Ted Cruz, what, to me, monster win for Ted Cruz. To have done anything else would have destroyed his brand. I mean, Donald Trump said his wife was unattractive. His dad was involved in the Kennedy conspiracy. I mean, it's unreal. This is great for him because keep in mind, you know, his brand is the turd in the punch bowl. You know, he is the uncompromising senator who always says no. And all of a sudden, he's positioned, if Trump loses or implodes, he's positioned to be the guy to tell the Republican Party, I told you so.
Yeah, that's also more, I mean, I tend to agree with you. Obviously, he is despised throughout the Republican establishment. That said, his brand, his self-image is that of the principled conservative. So he can certainly stand on that. That's the message that my Cruz sources were taking away from it, that he really burnished his position as the principled conservative and set the stage for him to be a major player in the post-November 8th realignment of the Republican Party should Trump lose, as the poll suggested he will, and as an early leader in the 2020 Republican presidential primary draft.
Right, and that's what the Trump folks have been saying, is that Ted Cruz is so selfish. I mean, think of the irony there, but they're saying Ted Cruz is so selfish playing for 2020. Well, that's on the table. Everybody knows that. The Cruz people acknowledge it. The Trump people acknowledge it. But, you know, the morning after, the final day of the convention, we're going into it, and where is the political discourse? Okay, you have Jeff Rowe, Cruz's top political operative and advisor, former campaign manager, blasting Chris Christie, saying that Chris Christie handed over his political balls to Donald Trump in a radio interview. You have Congressman Pete King from New York out there blasting away at Cruz, calling him an asshole. And you have Sean Spicer, the chief strategist for the RNC, like the number two at the RNC, basically, communications-wise, sitting here saying, I agree, I would call him an asshole too. He's saying that on CNN. This is what the country is seeing. And yes, it's, you know, an amazing pie in the face to Donald Trump at his own convention last night. Great TV, but is reality TV going to work all the way till November? Is that going to be enough? They're going to get huge ratings. They're going to get a big tune in. But are they converting anybody? Usually conventions, sorry to be boring and sort of, you know, cliche here, but this is supposed to be about, as Paul Manafort said on Monday, making Donald Trump believable as someone who can be president to the people who don't believe it yet. And I don't know if this week accomplishes it. It just shows that this is like a total, you know, carnival, and it's sort of interesting to watch.
Charlie.
But at least it sets the outlines for 2020 and 2024, because what we saw was fantastic political theater. Here is a Texas senator staring down the New York delegation, which is seated right in front of him, screaming at him, booing him as he's speaking. What better optics is there for a Texas senator to be hated by New York? And for him, it's a total win-win, because if he runs again, He would never win New York in a primary. He would never win New York in a general election.
Until he goes back to Wall Street begging for money hat in hand like he did right after the saying that
His wife got run off the floor last night. They were yelling, Goldman Sachs! That's what they were yelling at her. I mean, she's the Texas senator's wife, but she's also of New York. She's got that New York stain on her, too.
Well, you know, last word on this, though. It turns around the unity narrative. Okay, so everybody's complaining about the Republicans showing all manner of disunity this week. And what it did for Ted Cruz is create a 2020 narrative. But what it did for Donald Trump is say, the entire party is not united against me. They're united against Ted Cruz.
Yeah, I mean, it makes Donald Trump look less of an asshole than Ted Cruz. And perhaps that's, I guess, making him look more presidential by default.
But this has to be about more than just the party. This has to be about broadening Trump's appeal. This isn't doing that.
One of the most important pieces of this convention for the Trump campaign was getting the kids on stage. We've been hearing for weeks about the need to put the children on the stage to humanize this candidate. And all four of them appeared. And did they do it? I think they did. Charlie?
So last night, as you know, Kristen, I went down to the convention floor and decided to dirty my white gloves and actually pretend I was a reporter rather than an editor. And so,
editor and jeans and kind of stinky.
Right. I had a notebook with me and everything. So I talked to a whole bunch of delegates. And what I was really surprised at was so many of them thought that the Trump kids were the breakout stars of the convention. They kept talking about the children. And it's not just that they were talking about the children in terms of softening their father's edges. You see that at every convention. That's the role of the family. They felt that the children were very powerful validators of Trump's character and that they were the biggest proof of Trump's character. Their point being, it wasn't that they humanized him. It was that those kids seemed squared away, and what many delegates told me was they felt that there was a warmth of relationship there that told them something about Donald Trump. And that was really fascinating and suggested to me that these kids are going to be really powerful surrogates. And if you look at the speeches, like Donald Jr. And Tiffany the other day, they were extremely effective speeches. And in fact, Donald Jr., after seeing that speech, I'm convinced that guy is running for office.
That
right
was a
now,
political speech.
Right now, the New York, the New Jersey, the Connecticut state GOP chairs, have dispatched their minions to figure out what his residency is.
Right.
You know, because that guy is going to be a politician one day, and you can tell from the speech. And so they've been very effective. And among the delegates last night, all of them were talking about their big expectations for Ivanka.
Well, Ivanka is a star. She's the star of the family. She's the favored child, isn't she, Eli?
Yeah, she's the one that Trump sees as sort of the best ambassador of his brand, the best next-gen ambassador of the Trump brand. And she's, I think, you know, more comfortable being a socialite, more comfortable being a mogul in her own right, putting herself out there. But politics, she's a little more reticent and hesitant to really get out over her skis. Don Trump Jr. gave not just a great speech, but maybe one of the better articulations of conservative ideology that we've seen all week. And this from a guy who's, you know, the son of a candidate who a lot of people doubt his conservative credentials. So that was really impressive. And I think Charlie's right about that. But Ivanka has this sort of glamour to her and also smarts and a calmness that I think will be really interesting because, you know, again, I reported out a story this week about the Trump kids and about Jared Kushner's role in the campaign and talking to a lot of people who spent time around this family. You know, they say it's true. These kids all kind of have their, you know, they know what they're doing. They've got it together. They've taken on roles in this company and now in this campaign. Ivanka may have the most influence with her father in terms of adjusting his thinking. Don Jr. may be the most comfortable going out there publicly and sort of being, you know, putting his political hat on and beating up Ted Cruz or whatever. But, you know, together, this is really a family-run campaign right now. And it is, you know, somebody said to me, people don't like Donald Trump, but they say, I really like his kids. And this is a guy who's been around Trump a long time. And he says, my response to that is always, you know, that's a reflection of the man who raised them. And that's what they want voters to conclude also.
Ken, jump in.
Yeah, Ivanka brings something different than either Eric or Don. I mean, you know, the goal of the family of these conventions is to humanize and to talk about, you know, to relay personal anecdotes and talk about the candidate, the nominee as a person. We saw a little bit of that with Eric Trump talking about how his dad raised kids to be just as comfortable around construction sites as boardrooms. But Ivanka is really the one who's being relied upon to carry that message. And the reason is she has cross-cultural appeal. She's not, you know, Eric and Don can talk about like gun rights and immigration and take reporters out, you know, hunting in Iowa. That's not what Ivanka's going to do. She's not going to help him reach the Republican base necessarily. And that's not what this is about. This is a general election. This is about reaching out through every medium possible, including pop culture, where she is a much stronger brand than any of the kids and almost as strong of a brand, and certainly a better brand at this point than her father. That's her role. The folks I talked to in the Trump orbit think that she is uniquely suited to be able to fill it.
Why was she so reluctant? I mean, each of you has flicked at this a little bit. She was reluctant at the start of this campaign to get involved. Why do we think that was?
I mean, she's still reluctant. She's still reluctant to get involved in a political way, talking about any of these issues. You never hear her take a stand on any of the issues.
And yet, behind the scenes, she's pushing him in a different direction.
What she's pushing him to do is to moderate. And the reason why both she is reluctant to engage in some of these lightning rod political issues, and why she urges her father to kind of dial it back on some of the more controversial stands that he's taken. Going back to the birther issue, she was the one, my sources tell me, whispering in his ear saying, "Dad, please just cool it on this." And the reason for all that is because she is concerned about the brand, the family brand, the corporate brand, her fashion brand. And if this doesn't work out, again, as polls suggest that it won't with her dad in the White House, she needs to fall back on that. She's a relatively young woman with a young family. She takes the business seriously and sees the potential. Again, my sources tell me, sees the potential for his fiery political rhetoric to severely damage that brand.
So she's focused on the corporate brand, the business of the Trump empire. Her husband is focused on this campaign.
Well, her husband is a business guy in his own right, real estate guy, owns the New York Observer. I mean, her husband is sort of someone that Donald Trump looks at and sees, you know, a younger version of how he views himself.
That's
in
right.
His mid-30s. But you're right. And
but handsomer.
Yeah,
handsomer.
That's, you know, really in the eye of the beholder.
And better hair.
But no, everything Ken said about Ivanka being sort of the custodian of the family's brand and carrying that into the next generation is 100% right. And you can see that hesitation. I mean, you know, it wasn't just the birther thing. It's been several times throughout this campaign when she, you know, she's very aware of how things are being perceived, of the controversy. And so, you know, she was a brake pedal, whereas Corey Lewandowski was a gas pedal and saying, like, just keep saying it, you know, do whatever you got to do.
Corey Lewandowski was the Clippers cutting the brake wire.
He was.
Eli, tell me what Jared is actually doing on the campaign.
Well, I mean, he's doing a little of everything. I mean, up until now with the convention, you know, Manafort is brought in to be the convention manager. And Manafort has really been a big liaison to the RNC and involved in planning and figuring all this stuff out. And yes, he's strategic advisor also. Take it easy.
Heck of a job, man.
Heck of a job, Paulie. So, you know, what has happened with Jared is Jared has sort of, as he's gradually gotten to know Trump and trusted Trump, he has more and more been offering political advice and more taking the controls of the actual campaign, making hiring decisions, bringing in different people to do different jobs, and inserting himself in different ways. He's taken over the Sheldon Adelson portfolio. He now speaks with Adelson directly. I mean, he's Jewish, right? So he's an obvious person to sort of serve as an emissary to Adelson and to that community. He and Lewandowski sparred over that, but that is somewhere where he has sort of, you know, asserted and consolidated some power within the campaign. And he sort of uses his power in funny behind-the-scenes ways. Last week when the RNC members were here and they were sort of hammering out the rules and the platform, he was very involved in that, down to the nitty-gritty details. One plank that was proposed for the platform was to have the party state its support for declassifying the 28 pages of the 9/11 report dealing with the Saudis' possible role in 9/11. And, you know, interestingly, that was declassified. That's been declassified in the last week, and Saudis apparently played no role in 9/11. But he was worried about that, about the damage that that could do to a U.S. ally in the Middle East. Adelson was worried about it also.
Well, the
and
interesting
Jared
thing about
made
it.
Some calls and made, because that plank was approved, that Republicans you know, were going to put that in their platform and say, we want this declassified. And suddenly the committee voted and said, okay, never mind, we're taking that out. And nobody could figure out what had happened. And what had happened was Jared Kushner had made some phone calls.
And what was interesting about that to me was that it was the platform committee trying to square its platform with what Trump had previously said he was in favor of.
Trump himself said he wanted to talk about that, and someday they'll declassify it and maybe we'll know. So, yes.
And this is another example of the power duo of Ivanka and Jared trying to protect the brand and protect their dad.
He also, you know, he and Manafort overruled Trump or went around Trump and deleted the Star of David tweet that Trump, you know, got some hot water for. But Trump said, the hell with it. Leave it up. They deleted it anyway. It was a sensitive issue. Kushner wrote an op-ed defending Trump as, you know, my father-in-law is not an anti-Semite, kept the story going. And so, you know, he is sort of freelancing here a little bit. This is a strange campaign in that you don't really know who is the principal, right? Trump is the principal. He's at the top, but he doesn't know what he's doing. He's relying on a lot of other people. He's a CEO. He delegates. And the people below him, it's not clear if Kushner or Manafort is sort of really running things. They have different responsibilities. And so you're seeing a lot of political novices in terms of the family members, not Manafort, but everyone around him, sort of co-equals, making these decisions and kind of, you know, adjusting on the fly.
All right, let's jump to the next piece of data here. 30 is our number. That's how many major donors showed up for a meeting here in Cleveland behind closed doors with the super PAC that the Donald Trump team has given its blessing to. Now, Ken, why does this matter?
Well, the number 30 itself is actually not that impressive. And it speaks to the continuing reluctance of major donors to engage with and support the Trump campaign and its allied super PACs. I mean, this is my seventh convention, and it's really noticeable the lack of like major donors at some of these events, and the lack of big names and the sort of roster of the Republican Party's biggest whales who are here. Now, what's significant about this event that the 30 donors did attend is that the Trump campaign expressly, albeit somewhat unofficially, endorsed the super PAC that was hosting this. That is a complete 180-degree reversal of Donald Trump's very early stand against big donors, super PACs. That was a key part of his campaign, railing against his rivals, his opponents, as being beholden to these big donors, saying that he was separate from that, that he didn't want a super PAC. He actually disavowed several early super PAC efforts. How far we've come. Now they are not only blessing this super PAC, they are encouraging donors to give to it. And the reason why is quite simple. They look at the FEC reports and they see they are at a huge deficit to Hillary Clinton on the fundraising side through the campaign, through the party, through the super PAC. This super PAC that the Trump campaign blessed had raised about $2.1 million through the end of last month. There was another super PAC that's competing with it, just filed its FEC report this week. It raised about $5 million. Add those up, $7 million. Hillary Clinton super PAC, $59 million, and a lot more on the way. I see you shaking your head a little bit about my assertion that there's a gaping deficit. You know, the cash on hand is not that different on the campaign side. The FEC reports that came in yesterday show that Hillary Clinton and the Democratic Party have about $11 million more dollars in the bank than Donald Trump and the RNC. But that is you have to put that in perspective. Hillary and the DNC has raised so much more money already than the Trump campaign and has spent so much more money building this infrastructure. It's impossible to overestimate the imbalance that you're seeing from a campaign finance and campaign infrastructure.
Well, Trump's free media, right? Trump's free media can overcome $11 million easy.
No, absolutely not. That's not happening. I mean, look at the free media out of this out of this convention. It's just all bad. The tables have totally turned on that. You need money. You need infrastructure. You need get out to vote. The Republican Party, Donald Trump, they just don't have it. They don't have it anywhere near what the Democratic Party has done. I've been covering this stuff closely since the 2000 election. Campaign finance, campaign infrastructure, I've never seen an imbalance this great headed into a general election.
Charlie, do you have something to say? You've been shaking your head over there.
No, I'm not shaking my head. I'm shaking my head at how bad this room smells. I'm not kidding. This room that they stuck us in just reeks of BO.
I mean, the only thing is my deodorant, man. Ooh, to Cleveland. Ooh, to Lake Erie.
No, I wasn't shaking my head at what you were saying. I mean, I think the spending disparity is becoming really clear. When you take a look at the ad spending numbers in these markets and how much is being spent already by Hillary Clinton and pro-Hillary Clinton super PACs like Priorities USA, and there's just no way they're going to catch up. And I think that at the end of the day, if it remains close as it is in national polls, that could be the difference. You know, the huge spending disparity and all of the things that it will enable for the Clinton campaign to do that it will not, that the Trump campaign will not be able to do.
I mean, it's also important to note that particularly in the era of super PACs, it takes one person to sort of close that gap. And for the Republicans, that one person is none other than Las Vegas casino mogul Sheldon Adelson.
Whose plane is sitting right there over your right shoulder.
Oh, nice. I make it my business to try to, you know, stalk Sheldon, follow him around a little bit. I had three encounters with him so far where I've tried to get him to answer the question, the big question on everyone's mind, not just mine, but the entire Republican Party and certainly the Republican Party's sort of finance community. I asked him as he was getting out of his tricked out Audi A8 into his little scooter with his Mossad agents by his side to go into a Republican Jewish coalition event. Sheldon, when are you going to write the check? And no response. And then I asked him another question that's on a lot of people's minds who watch him obsessively, which is, are you still supporting Donald Trump after some of these missteps that have sort of been in an area that isn't particularly comfortable for Sheldon, that being the Star of David tweet, his suggestion that he wouldn't get between the Israelis and the Palestinians. These are not stances or behaviors that are consistent with what Sheldon Adelson wants to see. Adelson didn't answer that question. In fact, the Mossad agents separated me from earshot of him at
that
point.
How many events have you been tossed out of this week?
I've only been tossed out of two events so far.
That's so disappointing. That's not even close to the record.
I know, but one of them, I got some good color. I got into the Great America PAC. It's one of the other Donald Trump super PAC events that they held, and they had a number of big donors there. And what was so cool about it was that apparently it was hosted by Dan Gilbert, who is the owner of the Cleveland Cavaliers, who my sources tell me is amenable to supporting one of these pro-Trump super PACs. But the cool thing was the Cleveland Cavaliers championship trophy was in there, and I didn't want to out myself as a reporter by like posing with it and taking a selfie. But at the end, as I was getting tossed out by security, I was like, can you just wait? I just want to take a picture with it. Can you take my picture with this? And Harold Hams representative, this is a Texas oil billionaire who was present at that fundraiser. I asked her to take the picture, and she said not only would she not take the picture, but she would be canceling a previously scheduled interview with Harold Ham and one of our energy reporters, Andrew Restucia, who had set this up and apparently still went through with it, and the story was great. So kudos to Andrew. Shame on me for getting in the way of his reporting.
At least you didn't get arrested this week, right?
That's true.
We didn't have to
not
use those
yet.
Lawyers we had, those Cleveland attorneys.
Well,
we had
there's
on the
always Philadelphia.
There's one more night too.
Let's not worry about it.
Well, you know, Eli, you are according to the Politico guidelines that have been laid out, you are my buddy who I'm supposed to check with if I get in trouble. So if you do get a call at 4 a.m. tomorrow asking to come bail me out, I hope that you will remember this conversation fondly.
I will keep my ringer on tonight after I pass out.
Thank you, sir.
We're getting lots of texts and emails from our listeners, and Grace wants to know, what was the first election cycle that made each of you realize you were obsessed with politics, Ken?
Well, you know what? I wasn't that much of a political nerd growing up. And
just
it was
a regular nerd?
Just a regular nerd. That's right. No politics. And then it was actually in my first newspaper job working for the Journal Inquirer in Manchester, Connecticut in the late 90s. It was an afternoon daily newspaper, family-owned, still in existence, 6 days a week. Afternoon, of course, required me to get up very early. Not a huge fan of that. But I became a huge fan of politics, covering the 1998 Hartford County Sheriff's race, which was rife with allegations of campaign finance impropriety, illegal campaigning, intimidation. In fact, while I was covering it, I was accosted by a deputy for the incumbent sheriff at a bar in West Hartford and threatened. The guy told me that he saw that one of my taillights was out and it'd be a shame if I got pulled over for that and something happened to me. And I was like, oh shit, I love this.
Who can running forget afoul that election?
Of authorities, running afoul of authorities from an early age.
Eli, your turn.
I don't know how I'll ever top
I
that.
I don't know how you will.
No, it was 92. It was the Clinton H.W. Bush Ross Perot race. You know, I was about 12 years old. My parents were, I mean, the reason I'm a journalist and the reason I'm interested in politics, I think, is because my parents, we ate dinner and watched the nightly news every night. They got Newsweek and Time magazine delivered to the house, and I'd read it. And in that year, 92, I don't know what the hell grade I was, in eighth grade, I guess, and I had to do a project on this. And I wrote a report about, like, Bill Clinton. We each had to take a candidate. I took Bill Clinton. And I wrote, remember writing this report, and then I did this other report on, like, TV news. And I remember dressing up as Ross Perot and slicking my hair down and, like, you pretending I was like doing, like, an infomercial. It's the ears. You really want to talk.
Burn.
And like, you know, mimicking his voice and pointing at charts and things. But that was the first one. I think just when I was old enough to really pay attention to what was going on, or I was sort of captivated by the personalities and by the election. And I've been interested in them ever since.
Charlie?
Mine is pretty easy for me. It was 1988 presidential election. I remember that just because I was in college at the time, and I knew nothing about politics when I went to college. In fact, I still remember the humiliation of a politics 101 course when I didn't know the difference between the state Senate and the U.S. Senate. But like so many other people, I had this great professor, and she was amazing, got me totally jazzed up about politics. I ended up taking an internship on the Hill as a result of her, and she was a great teacher. And then I decided that I wanted to see what it was like to go to a presidential campaign, because I kept reading about this presidential campaign. And so I tried to figure out how to get to Iowa. And I found a campaign that was looking for, you know, cannon fodder like me, like idiotic college kids with a lot of energy that would sort of just do anything. I didn't even know anything about the candidate at the time. I took a bus all the way to Iowa from Washington, D.C., and knocked on doors. Had no idea what to say when I met people there. But after that, I was totally hooked. I thought it was amazing.
So romantic.
For whom were you door knocking?
That is on a need-to-know basis.
That's it for us.
What about you, Kristen?
No, I'm saving my stories. I'm saving my stories for another episode.
Oh, come on.
For next week when you shit on Philly?
Another episode. Maybe for when I shit on Philly. Nope. I've got good stories.
You got to keep on tuning in to Nerdcast to hear about how Kristen Roberts became a political nerd.
Such a tease.
Peace out. Say goodbye to our listeners. Goodbye, Charlie Mattesian.
Goodbye.
Eli.
Goodbye, Cleveland.
Ken.
See you guys next week in Philly, the birthplace of our nation and home of the Philadelphia Eagles and Charlie Mattesian.
Cut his mic.
Next week, I'm going to bring it. It's going to be so anti-Philly up in this joint. Goodbye.